Hello and welcome to Aut Hour, the podcast where I interview other autistic authors. My name is Sarah Gibbs. I'm the author of Drama Queen, One Autistic Woman and a Life of Unhelpful Labels. And occasionally I am a comedy writer as well. Today's guest has written, I think, one of the most important books of all time. And I'm not exaggerating or blowing sunshine. I was gobsmacked when I read it. I think it is a life-saving book for people who most need it. I think it's going to change and save the lives of so many people. It's called Queerly Autistic, The Ultimate Guide for LGBTQIA plus teens on the spectrum, and it's by Erin Eakins, who I have the great pleasure of talking to today. Welcome, Erin.
Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Great. Thank you. All the better for talking to you. So excited because, oh my God, this book was just, I mean, you know, I didn't know what to expect because obviously I'm an adult and like I never sort of know what to expect with books that are targeted at younger people. But I learned so much from it. And I was just putting myself in the shoes the whole time of a young autistic person, a young autistic queer person reading it. And it just feels to me like, first of all, a pragmatic how-to guide for how to get through those difficult decisions, conversations, realizations, everything else. But it was done in such a big sisterly, hand-holding way. Like I imagine it's going to, I mean, I just think it's world-changing, and I think it should be on the curriculum. I think everyone should read it. I mean, there's so much I want to talk to you about it. I just wanted to gush because it's amazing, and you're amazing, and thank you very much for putting that into the world.
Thank you so much. This is just, you said I'm going to start off and I'm going to make a cry. But there's it feels like what I set out to do. When people tell me things like that, it feels like what I set out to do has actually been achieved. Because I was kind of writing it from the perspective of almost like hand-holding my younger self.
I mean, that's how it felt, but it was so clear and concise, and you didn't waste a single word. Like I learned an enormous amount. There's so much in it, but you say it in such a clear way, and you repeat what needs to be repeated, and every section is relevant to the person that needs to read it. It's just like, it's so thorough and so well done. It couldn't possibly be confusing. And I think that's so important because it's such a confusing time of your life, especially if you're grappling with these really important questions about your identity.
So confusing, so confusing. I think that was, and I had to be really tough with myself when I was writing it, because it's obviously, this is a special interest of mine as well as a personal experience. Mm. So, you know what it's like when you get start talking about a special interest.
Yeah, my special interest isn't that life-saving. Mine is neighbours. So,
well, see, my other special interests are less life-saving. I mean, you've got this, and then on the other hand, you've got, I could probably write just as long a book about EastEnders, and that's considerably less life-saving. I had to be really kind of strict with myself, and I wrote a lot that I then really edited down. I was really lucky to have a lot of really supportive friends on board who would go through and help me edit it down as well. So that was a life-saving thing to have, that I had people that would go, oh, you've waffled a bit here, and I'm like, okay, fine, I'll pare that down a little bit. But it's good to know that it's because it was such a kind of a brutal process trying to make it as concise as I wanted it to be, when I could probably have waffled on for about 500 more pages.
Well, you've got to save something for the next book.
Absolutely.
So I want to talk about the book a lot, but first I want to hear about you and your late autism diagnosis. So you first of all, you said in your book that you came out in your teens as bisexual at university. Is that
so? I came out just before going to university. It was sort of a kind of a gradual process. So I came out around about the age of 16-17, but it was going to university where it was sort of the opportunity to be like, right, I'm surrounded by people I don't know, so I'm going to introduce myself as the bisexual one, and actually kind of have that as part of my identity from the start. That was when I really started kind of coming into that identity. And it was through that university work, because I did a lot of kind of campaigning at university once I realised that the social side of things was something that, just because it was queer, didn't mean that I could suddenly do it. Which is obviously, not having the diagnosis was something that was a proper struggle, because you expect to sort of go out and find your place and be like, oh, I've come home, it is my space. But the same issues of being a neurodivergent person in neurotypical spaces were still there. It was just more rainbowy. So I did a lot of, started doing a lot of more sort of the campaigning side of, you know, being a bit more shouty and getting involved with the student union, introducing things like gender neutral toilets into the union buildings and things like that. That was sort of where I found my niche.
Amazing. It's so interesting that you say that, because that's something that Hannah Gadsby talks about in her stand-up as well, that that like LGBTQ plus spaces tend to be loud. And pride is loud and colourful. And like, if you're neurodivergent, and what was that she said, that her favourite sound is the sound of a spoon hitting a cup of tea, like that's that can be really, really tough for you. So how you got your diagnosis quite a lot younger than I did. I had another sort of 10 years of confusion and having no idea. How did yours come about? Was that part of the process?
I really struggle because technically my diagnosis is a late diagnosis, but compared to a lot of people I know, I have a relatively early diagnosis. So I mean, it speaks a lot for how many people are not getting diagnosed. So I was about 20, 21, so I'd finished university. And I was sort of running around trying to figure out, what do I do now? And I was working in Greggs at the time, and really struggling with it. And, you know, because there was, not knowing that there was, that I was kind of autistic, there was no, I couldn't ask for any accommodations. Mm. So I was just really struggling with kind of, and people get very upset about sausage rolls. I mean, I understand sausage rolls are important. I do understand that, but people get very abusive about sausage rolls. And so I was really struggling and sort of wow. having that come down from being, because I'd struggled at university. I'd really enjoyed the course and the academic element, but all the other bits that you're supposed to do at university, I'd really struggled with. I struggled with living with other people. Mm. At one point, I was actually living with my godmother lives in, I went to university in Cardiff. My godmother lived in a teeny tiny little village just outside of Usk in Monmouth. So I was kind of commuting into university every day and going, I was very privileged to be able to stay in her house for a bit when my housing situation and living with other people got to the point where I actually wasn't eating because I wasn't leaving my room. Because I didn't want to bump into anybody else.
Oh, I relate so hard to that.
So it was like I'd like kind of have a little stash of sweets in my room, and that would be all I would eat, because the kitchen was communal, and that was too much stress. Yeah. And so I'd kind of come through university, and I hadn't had the experience I was expecting. And I was working at Greggs, and I was really struggling. Really struggling to kind of put down who am I, what am I doing, what's life, I don't understand. My best friend, who I actually met on a Torchwood fan forum back when I was 16, she casually dropped into a conversation that we were having on chat. She casually dropped in that, oh, I'm ASD. And I was like, what does that mean? So I Googled it, and it came up with, you know, autism spectrum disorder. And my first thought was, really? She is? And then that went to, but I'm really similar to her. And then that kind of spiraled into a rabbit hole where I was doing all of those online quizzes and reading lots of people's experiences, and eventually spoke to my mum and said, I think this might be me. And our only experience with autism was actually my godmother, who helped me out so much at university. Her son was diagnosed as Asperger's. That was his official diagnosis, although obviously that whole diagnosis is not something that's used anymore. At the time, his diagnosis was Asperger's, and I was very different to him in many ways. That was our only experience of it. But then I showed her all of these. I showed her my research. I brought my receipts. And she said, oh, yes. And I was seeing a psychiatrist at the time for depression, because they'd put me through like cognitive behavioural therapy and all of these things on the NHS. And then we're like, why is this not working? So I was referred to a psychiatrist. And one of the first things my mum said in one of our appointments was, we think Erin might be autistic. And he laughed and sort of went, oh, no, but you're talking to me. You're making eye contact with me. and, you know, oh, you're such a bright young woman. And I was my mum, luckily, is like, when it comes to me and my brother, she's a bit like, she's very protective, and she can be a bit like a dog with a bone, thankfully. And so I wouldn't have had the kind of mental strength to be able to argue with someone in such authority, a position of authority. But she said, but she just would not let it go. She said, I think you should refer for us for an assessment. Oh, come on, you can at least refer us for an assessment. Doesn't it seem like you could refer us to an assessment? And eventually,
I love my mum.
Eventually, he actually referred us to our local hospital's autism unit. I think just to make us leave.
I mean, that in itself tell him something. That, I mean, if doctors are referring us to get rid of us, there's probably a reason.
Yeah, exactly. And I think his thought was, I'll refer them, they'll leave, they'll go to the autism unit, and the autism unit will laugh them away. But obviously, we then waited a really long time. I think it was about maybe up to a year for the actual appointment. And then we had the initial appointment, and then I think about 4, 5, 6 months later, we had the follow-up appointment, which was the actual we're going to diagnose you or not diagnose you appointment. And we had this huge kind of conversation where we talked about my childhood, my history, where I was currently. It's probably about 2 hours, I think it was, we were talking. And they said, bear with us 1 second. They stepped out of the room for no more than about 10 minutes, came back in and said, yeah. and that was it. So I was 23 when that happened, and it was this moment I always refer back to. I think I even quoted Hannah Gadsby in my book. I love her so much. I think I quoted her in saying it was like being given the key to the city of me.
Yeah,
like it wasn't this life ending, oh no, she's autistic. It was this whole, we were nervous that they were going to say I wasn't, because if I wasn't, then what was going on? And I'd since found out from my stepmom that the night before that appointment, my mum was actually in tears, because she was actually worried about what would happen if they said I wasn't. She wasn't crying about whether I was, oh no, they might say she's autistic. She was crying, what if they say she isn't?
Your mum is amazing.
She's always been very kind of like my number one advocate. And I think, you know, going back to like writing the book, something that really came across was how really privileged I am to have a parent who will do that for me. And, you know, so many people, you know, I wrote a whole chapter on coming out, and one thing that I had to really focus on in the chapter was, how do you make sure your parents are safe? You know, don't come out if it's not safe. You know, have secret bank accounts, you know, if you need them, have places you can go. Because I know so many autistic and queer people who don't have that level of support. Yeah. And so it's a privilege. And she's a teacher, so she puts her teacher voice on, and people sort of go, okay.
Yeah, it's so important to have someone in your corner. I mean, I have my husband who advocates for me in situations like that, but I know so many people who don't, and it's heartbreaking. You know, both autistic and queer, I've had friends who came out as gay and their parents did not react well, and they had to come and stay with me for a while. So I've had situations like that, so, you know, seen firsthand. It's, I don't know what it's like to come out as gay, but like it's I know how rare it is for people to just be amazing. I think maybe hopefully less rare these days, but still, you know, you just don't know. So yeah, it's wonderful to have somebody in your corner, and everyone, autistic, queer, like whatever is going on for you, you deserve someone advocating for you and backing you and being there with you and holding your hand and not taking no for an answer. Because when it's you, it's so easy to just be gaslit into thinking that that you've imagined it, or it's a phase, or you know, you're making a big deal of nothing. It's so easy to absorb those messages, like you said, especially when they're coming from someone in a position of authority. So like, well done to your mum, like gold star, top marks,
top parenting marks, definitely. And also obviously a shout out to my best friend Fiona as well. We're still best friends now, nearly seven, eight years down the line. She actually told me a couple of years after that, she actually told me that she deliberately kind of slipped into the conversation because she knew I would Google it. And she didn't really know how to tell me. So I owe a lot to her for kind of noticing it and kind of pushing me in that direction. But she didn't know how to say, I think you might be autistic. So she just put something, the abbreviation, because she just knew that I would go and Google it, because we're very similar. And my friend Fiona, she's actually not officially diagnosed. But her sibling is diagnosed. So she's seen that process, and she'd been identifying as autistic. She's self-diagnosing for a while, and she's actually never sought out a professional diagnosis. It's why I'm so supportive of self-diagnosis as well, because she's so clearly autistic.
Yeah.
She's just never felt... because the getting the diagnosis for her sibling was so traumatic, and she didn't want to go through that. Which I get.
Totally understandable. I mean, given how people respond, like, oh, you can make eye contact. I was told, you know, there's no point getting a diagnosis because there's no cure, by my GP. Like, what are you meant to, like... And also, it's such an elitist process, and it's such a privileged process. You need somebody fighting for you, and you probably need to go private because it's so difficult to get a diagnosis on the NHS. So, like, self-diagnosis is it, really, for most people.
Oh, exactly. One of my other best friends, who I met through a different fandom, she actually approached her GP about a potential ADHD assessment, and her GP said, oh yeah, you're I think you're definitely ADHD, but I'm not going to refer you to an assessment because A, you probably won't get it, and B, they're probably, you know, it's really hard for you as a grown adult woman to get that assessment. It's going to be really difficult, and I think it may actually cause you more harm and trauma going through that process. And that's a GP said that to my friend. So my friend has been self-diagnosed as ADHD for quite a while, just because it's just so inaccessible. And I don't disagree that potentially going through the process could be more trauma than is worth it at the end of the day. It's not a good situation.
It's not. I mean, I always advocate for if you can get a diagnosis through, but I didn't think about that, like the trauma of going through it. The reason I say that is because then you have legal protection in the workplace.
Absolutely.
If you're ADHD, you have access to medication that could help. Like, so that's sort of why I've always said, if you can get a diagnosis, try to. But like, yes, it can be massively traumatic as well. And it's sort of pot luck, it seems to be, as to whether or not you get a good clinician or someone who really understands what autism is, or if their training isn't 20 years out of date.
It's such a postcode lottery. It's like, if you've got, I mean, luckily I feel like the autism centre in my local hospital, I feel like it was part of their mental health unit, was actually quite good. And I think was quite kind of open and quite kind of up to date with kind of current thinking around it, because it was, well, I think it was what, eight, no, six, 7 years ago, and they were already working on the we don't diagnose people with Asperger's anymore, so they were kind of quite up, like, on it. But I know other areas that are not like that.
No, it can be really, really tricky. Coming back to the book, because I think, God, I can't gush about this book enough. I really just, if you know anybody, I mean, no, you know what, like, I'm not even going to put parameters on it, just read it, because, like, everybody knows somebody who is LGBTQIA+, everybody knows somebody who is autistic, even if you don't know it, and this book, even if it's not you who's going through it, will help you to know how to better support people who are trying to come out or trying to understand their own sexual identity or their own gender identity or whatever else it is. So how did the idea for the book come about, and what was your route to getting it published?
It's still a little bit of a blur, because it's one of those things that you read about, other people talk about this happening, and then it happens to you and you're like, oh, okay. And I always joke that it's the one time in my life I've ever tried networking, and I got a book deal out of it. So it actually came about because I went to a Q&A around the launch of Owl and Fox Fisher's book, Trans Teen Survival Guide.
Oh, I love Owl and Fox.
I love them so much. And so I went to this Q&A that they were doing. I think it was like in Tottenham Court Road, and no one was available to come with me, so I almost didn't go. But then I was like, no, I'll go on my own. I'll be a big girl. I'll try my best. So I went on my own. And they said that their publishers were there, and I'd heard of Jessica Kingsley previously, and I knew they did a lot of stuff on autism, and so I actually kind of took me a while to get the guts to do it, but I actually approached the people from Jessica Kingsley who were at the event, and what I actually asked them was that I had, at the time, I had a cousin who was transitioning, and she was she's about 10 years younger than me, and she's autistic as well. And I went to them and I said, look, I have a family member who is transitioning, and she's really struggling, and she's autistic, and I just wondered if you have any books in your kind of, you know, that you publish that you can recommend to me. And they said, well, actually, we don't, which then ended up this huge conversation about that was what they want. They did want to have some books like that. And I was like, oh, well, I write a blog in my spare time. And I said, if you ever have any books you want reviewing, I'd be really happy to do that. But I write about this kind of topic. And they ended up giving me we ended up kind of swapping email addresses. And I said, well, if you're interested in my work, funnily enough, I'm actually appearing on the Victoria Derbyshire show tomorrow morning to talk about bisexuality.
Wow.
And they were like, oh, okay, we'll check you out. And then after that, I got actually got an email from the guy in question. He said, he was like, do you want to pitch some ideas for a book? So I pitched some ideas. This was the top one. This was the one that I wanted to do. And he said, I really like that one. Can you just, you know, do a quick kind of, do a preliminary chapter and a chapter plan and send it in to us, and then we'll look at whether or not it's something we want to publish, but we think we do. And then 3 months down the line, I had a contract signed, and the book was starting to be written, and it was one of those things where you think won't happen to you. because I'm not sure I would have pushed, is something that I would have known how to get into outside of that. I was really lucky to have kind of been in the right place at the right time, and having a good enough day that I was able to talk to a stranger.
Yeah. Oh, God. I mean, it's such a it's such an example to young writers. It's like, you know what, put yourself out there, and tell people you're a writer, even if you haven't had anything published yet, and be confident in yourself. Amazing that you were on TV the next day as well. That made you look hella swagger, like, amazing. I can't get away with that. I'm so middle class. But yeah, what a story. I love that so much. It feels like a fairy tale, really.
It's still a bit baffling to me that it happened. Even like now that I've kind of got the book and it's here and it's been written, and you know, we're talking about it and people have read it and people are definitely buying it because I'm getting my royalty checks through. And it's still a little bit of a fuzziness. It's like, oh, because I've always wanted to be a published author, but I always thought that, because I started writing stories when I was about 5 years old. I've got all these notebooks, and I wanted to be a fantasy writer, and then I wanted to be a comedy writer, and then I wanted to write this, and then I wanted to write hard hitting fiction, and kind of, it was really, I never considered that maybe the area in which that I was meant to write for, and now I'm writing in the area I really feel like it fits me, was actually not fiction at all. So it really was sort of a dream come true, but not in the way that I ever thought it would happen.
Totally. And you know what's great about writing is that you're not confined to one space. Like, this may be like the perfect thing that fits you right now, and also launches you onto, you know, a bigger platform and helps so many people. And then down the line, it may be that you come back to fiction. It might be something that you get the itch to do again, and you'll have this incredible platform to pitch your books from. Like, I've just written my memoir is factual, and then like my next book is fiction. And another thing that I'm doing is fiction, and like I'm doing some narrative TV stuff. So it all kind of like you can be versatile, and like you're not constrained. The world is your oyster, especially now that I think it's been, you know, from the outside certainly it looks like a runaway success, and I think it's only going to keep snowballing because more and more people are sort of coming around to the truth of the situation, is that you can't ignore somebody out of their reality, and you can't talk somebody out of who they are, and hopefully more and more parents and teachers are going to be looking at this in a supportive way. And you know, I'm hoping that it's going to be a book that autistic teenagers can read with their parents rather than hiding it under the bed covers. You know, I really, really hope that that's sort of my dream for you and for people and for humanity in general. It's so thorough, the book, so thorough. It misses nothing out. How long did it take to research, and which section was the most challenging to research and write?
I think I was writing it for, I think between getting the contract and it actually, you know, appearing on shelves, was just over 2 years. And I did get several extensions on my deadline. And luckily, working with a publisher like Jessica Kingsley, where they publish a lot of work by autistic and otherwise neurodivergent people, I think they're kind of well versed in that, in that they're kind of understanding of those access needs. So I was able to get some extensions on my deadline, fortunately. But I think the most challenging area of research was that I think the pressure that I put myself under was in writing the sections around being trans. Because as someone who as I got older, has developed maybe a more interesting relationship with my own gender and looking at it. But I've never identified it as trans. But I do a lot of work and have a lot of friendships with a lot of trans people. And I really, particularly in the autistic community, and I was so, for a while, I considered not having that area in the book because I felt I'm not trans, it's not my place. But it really just didn't feel like I could write this book without having the transness and the gender identity element to it. So instead, I really kind of focused in on like, this is an area I have to get this right. And I have to say in the book that this is not my personal experience, and you know, the best thing to do is to speak to other trans people. But I really wanted to get that bit right. I think overall the kind of the figuring it out section around gender identity, and the chapter around transitioning. I think they ended up being the longest chapters in the book, and they're definitely the ones that took me the longest to write. I think the transitioning chapter was about probably took me altogether probably about 6 months to write, and it didn't help that a lot was happening in this country. It was not good around that area. I think one of the most devastating things I ever had to do was we were maybe a month or two out from publication. I think it was maybe sort of late January, February, and publication date was the 21st of April. And I had to get in touch with my publisher and say the High Court in the UK has just made it very difficult for people to get hormone blockers. And I have a little section on hormone blockers. So literally right down to the wire, I had to write this really devastating short section in the book saying there has been this ruling that makes it more difficult to get hormone blockers. This hopefully will change, and hopefully the book will be really out of date soon, and that, you know, because people are fighting this and are trying to fight this. But for now, be aware that you may find it difficult to access hormone blockers. That doesn't mean you shouldn't fight for them if you need them, but it does mean that there's an extra barrier in your way. And
outrage.
It was just one of the most devastating things I had to do. But it had to, it had to be in there, because I couldn't have the book go out and say, yeah, you can ask for hormone blockers, or you know, this is what they do and this is something that's available, without having that caveat of actually in this country at the minute, this is really difficult for you to get. And also, here are some outlets to keep an eye on. Here are some organisations that can support you if you need them but can't access them. And here are some people and some organisations that are actually fighting this ruling at the moment. As I said in my book, I said, this is such an ever-changing situation. This will probably be out of date. This book will be out of date very soon, but I actually hope it is. Things like that. It was also kind of trying to keep on top of an ever-changing situation in this country that was, unfortunately, although we have had some good stuff, you know, come out recently, it was actually a getting increasingly more negative aspect of it. And that was those were the most challenging ones to do, simply because I didn't have the personal experience, but also because I put so much pressure on myself to get them right.
Well, I mean, I'm not trans, obviously, so I can't say whether or not you got it right from that perspective, but I certainly learned so much that I didn't know before. I just want to take a second to say that this is obviously a trans inclusive podcast, but I think it needs to go further than that, because I just want people who are listening, our trans listeners in particular, to know that, like, there are people out there who completely support your rights, who will fight for your rights, who won't tolerate transphobia, and who are 100% behind you. And I know that right now I cannot imagine what it feels like. It must feel like the whole world is against you, and it must feel so hostile and so scary. But, like, there are so many people who support you and are here for you. And it sounds so trite to say this isn't forever, but, like, these fucking dinosaurs and their bloody ridiculous opinions are on their way out. I hope. I really, really hope that they are the past and not the future. And if there's anyone who is transphobic who's listening, you're not welcome here.
absolutely. And and I want to say that for all my spaces as well. It's not something that I'm even willing to discuss. It's not a discussion that should be had. There's no discussion here. This is, and I think particularly around, I think certain elements have really latched onto the autistic side of things to try and discredit young people's trans identities, is because so many autistic people don't identify as cis. It's definitely something that's been particularly latched onto as, oh, we'll see, these people don't really know themselves, they're being taken advantage of because they're autistic and they can't kind of have that self-determination and autonomy. So there's this really insidious mixture of transphobia and anti-autistic ableism that's really come through and is coming through in the legal cases that we're seeing. The one that actually ended with it making it difficult for young people to get hormone blockers or puberty blockers was one of the anonymous people who actually took, who actually testified or kind of took Tavistock to the court. They actually then did an interview with the Daily Mail, because of course they did an interview with the Daily Mail, saying that it was, they did it for that because their autistic child was identifying as trans, and that they didn't want their autistic child to be able to access this support because they felt like they were being misled because they were autistic. I mean, thankfully it was anonymous and their autistic child didn't know that their parent was doing this. And I think, although obviously that must be terrible to not have a supportive parent, part of me is really glad that the child in question didn't know that their parent was doing this, because I can't imagine what that must feel like. But I mean, it was really tied up in with it. And so that anti-autistic hatred, that feeling that autistic people don't have autonomy and that we don't know ourselves, that kind of has been a really big part in a lot of the transphobia that we're seeing.
Feels like, have you ever met an autistic person? Like, yeah. We are the most decisive in our opinions that you could possibly.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just so infuriating.
Very, very, just so angry. But in better news, I also had to make a last minute revision to the book, because I had included Elliot Page as an example in the lesbian section. And then obviously he came out so wonderfully, and so I moved them to the queer section. And so that was really lovely to be able to write and quote what he had said in his coming out post, and be like, oh, this happened in, you know, whenever it happened. So that was really a lovely change that I had to make last minute.
Well, it's nice to have some good news. And you know, like I say, if anyone is listening and feeling lonely and terrified, we see what's going on. We believe you and we love you, and please hang in there and read Erin's book, not in a promotey way, but like it'll help. I really, really do think it will help make you feel less alone, and the resources that you put in there as well will help to find a community and to connect you to people who are like-minded and who can help you get through this, because it's a shitty time and everyone needs to stick together.
It's very shitty. And also I would say just a shout out that I wasn't able to do in my book, because the book that I'm shouting out actually came out about 3 or 4 weeks before my book came out, so I didn't actually have the chance to direct to it. That Jessica Kingsley, my publishers, actually have also published a survival guide for young trans and autistic people by Jan Perkis and Wen Lawson, which I just want to really push that, because if you're looking for kind of something that's written by some trans autistic people, you're not going to find a better book than that, because I think when and Yen are such kind of wonderful advocates and people in the community, and they have a wealth of personal experience as well as professional experience and research experience. So yeah, I think it's I think it's the Trans Autistic Guide or the Autistic Trans Guide, I can't remember, but it's definitely one that if you're looking to feel seen, I think, or looking for advice or support, that's definitely a more kind of directly streamlined towards being trans and autistic. I'll sing that book's praises forever.
Amazing. I'll put that in the show notes so that we definitely make sure that people have access to that. And also, it sounds like I should get them on the podcast next season. This is
absolutely.
Actually, I didn't mention this. I will say at the end, this is the season finale. So so yeah, we're going offline for a few months while I recover my spoon. So it's been an amazing thing, but so much.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
But yes, I definitely recommend Wen and Yen. I've not met Yen in person, but Wen I met at a conference, and he's just absolutely wonderful, so knowledgeable, but absolutely wonderful, and just a really lovely person to talk to. So yeah, I do recommend him.
Fantastic. Oh, so that we're really getting into it here.
Yeah.
And I don't want to make this all about me, but there are some things, like the book was so helpful in working things out that actually I realized a few things. And it's something that I've said kind of quietly in a whisper or privately to friends for many years, but it's not something I've ever had the courage to say in public before. I feel like your book explaining the difference between, first of all, romantic and sexual feelings, and also that you can be more attracted to one gender or the other, or more than one gender, and so on. Like, I didn't ever realize that I was allowed to say that I'm bisexual, because I married a man, and because I never had a long-term relationship with a woman. I felt like that was sort of, I don't know, co-opting an identity or appropriating, and so I never had the courage to say it, and that's probably the first time I've said the words out loud.
I wish you could see me. I'm beaming from ear to ear, because I love hearing that was what I wanted when I wrote it, and I've had people tell me similar stories to that, and it's just really overwhelming, because that moment of being able to say it, it's that same thing of when you get that diagnosis of being autistic. It's again that, ooh, the key to the city of me sort of thing, to borrow and steal from Hannah Gadsby, because she's brilliant.
I think, you know, it's so wonderful to say it out loud. It doesn't change anything about my life, and like, it's, you know, but it's just so nice to understand myself better and to know what these feelings are. And I think when I was younger, I was really confused about it and thought, I'm not allowed to have these feelings. That was a big thing that I felt in the community that I grew up in, was so discriminatory, and it, you know, gay was a dirty playground insult, and you know, the idea that I could be gay was terrifying, and I remember trying to repress it so hard. But I liked boys as well, and I was so confused.
So confusing, isn't it? I was reading my diary from when I was 12 a little while ago, because I had a big clear out, and I had this whole page where I was like, oh my god, I think I'm gay, and I have a crush on my teacher and all of this. And then the very next day I was like, well, this is very stupid, because Leonardo DiCaprio is really pretty, so clearly I'm not gay. And reading that as an adult who is now out and has been out for over a decade is like, wow, baby Erin.
Well, thank you so much for giving me permission to just acknowledge that side of my sexuality, and I really, you know, thank you, because I don't think I ever would have done that otherwise.
Bless you.
So that really means a lot to me, and one of the many ways that this book will always mean a lot to me. You know, was that giving of permission a conscious decision when you were writing the book, where you were aware that that's what you were doing for people?
I think it's what I wanted to do. I think that, like, putting it in words like that, I feel like that was what I wanted to do, but maybe I didn't have the words to explain that that was what I wanted to do. Mm. But I think something that I just really wanted to put throughout is, you know, that identities and labels are, if they're not important to you, they're not important to you. But if they are important to you, that's okay as well. But also, you're allowed to play around with them, and you're allowed to. And I wanted to be like, we think there's all these rules, and I lived by that for a really long time. I mean, I was out when I was 17, but for a really long time I felt like I really had to prove myself to be a part of the community, and I wanted to kind of get across to people that you don't have to do that, and that you are, by nature of being who you are, is enough. And also because I think sometimes we have a little bit of a toxic environment, particularly in an online queer spaces, where we're very rigid, and you can only identify as this if you do this, and if you identify as this, and you have certain privilege over this, and I've been so damaged by that, and I as kind of, even in my early 20s, being on Tumblr and whatever, I wanted to say that you know, you need, you know, you you can just be you. And if a label works for you, and you know, and I wanted people to feel empowered to be able to say I'm this, and I claim this space. And yeah, it was just so important to me, because I know how damaging that had been to me.
Well, I think you certainly achieved that. I mean, yay. I'm 34. I was going to say 33. I had my birthday. Damn it. Damn you, time. I'm 34, and you know, if I can realize that at my age, then it's just never too late to just,
yes, never just too late,
change your identity. And even if it doesn't change anything, you know, I am married to a man, and I don't have any plans to not be married to him in the, you know, I hope, touch wood, now I'm jinxing it. You know, but it's just part of who I am, and yeah, it's always been part of who I am, and it's just nice to be able to say it, and not to feel like weird, yeah, about it.
And it's never too late. I mean, I think I mentioned it a few places in the book, but I didn't go into it in a huge amount of detail. But my mum came out when she was 50. So I was 20, I think, or nearly 21 when my mum came out. And my mum came out as gay when she was 50, and she'd been married to my dad for 25 years. Mm-hmm. And she said that part of the reason that got her to realise that she was gay was actually me being so out.
Wow.
And it's that power of, you know, you don't realise how powerful it is when you're kind of out and you're just doing what you do and being yourself. And other people see that, and that can have an impact that you don't even realize that it's having. So you know, it's never too late. And my mum didn't even realize she was gay until she was 50. It wasn't that she'd been, I mean, obviously she'd been repressing it, but it was a subconscious repression,
yeah,
for so long. And she realized that she was gay and came out when she was 50, and now she's married to my stepmom. She's married, I think it was coming up for five years now. So it's never too late, and she's almost like got a completely new lease of life at the age of 50, and that was like a new beginning. And so it just being who you are can have such an impact on people that you don't realize that it's having.
God, I'm so glad you two have each other. Like, it just sounds like such a wonderfully empowering relationship for both of you. And you know, you teach her and she supports you, and oh man, ah, the feels.
I know. She gives good hugs too.
Oh, your mum sounds amazing. Aside from family, another thing that's been so important to you in terms of self-discovery is fandom. That was how you found out you were autistic. And you talk a lot about it in the book as well, in terms of playing around with your identity and using fandom in that way. What role do you think fandom plays in these really important self-discoveries?
I think a more important role than I think a lot of people are willing or that a lot of people want to admit. I think, you know, it's more socially acceptable to say I came out because I realized I was this identity because I met someone or I met someone who was that identity or whatever reason. If you say I realized I was bisexual because of a fictional character, it's sort of a, excuse me, you did a what because of what? But that's exactly how I figured out that I was bisexual. It was because I mean, for my sins, I was a Torchwood fan. Apparently, I always really get into the aside, but I always really, really get deep into fandom for sequel series that are not as good as the original series. I was just looking up, I was redoing my bookshelf the other day, and I have a couple of Doctor Who bits, and I have a couple of like Buffy the Vampire Slayer bits, but I have so many Torchwood action figures and books, and I have so many Angel action figures and books. No. And I'm like, these were sequels that I know were not as good as the original series. Objectively, I know that, but for some reason they suckered me in. I don't know what that says about me, but you know, so you know, it was I figured out I was bisexual because of a bisexual character in Torchwood, and that was Yanto Jones, he of the suits and the excellent coffee. And no, it's been It's been over 12 years since I killed him off, and I'm still not over it. I will never be over it. I will always be angry about it. But there we go. That's how I figured it out. And writing and talking with other people about, particularly around writing fan fiction, that a lot of queer people I know kind of explored the kind of the sexuality aspects of it through writing fan fiction. And I know particularly a lot of queer women who wrote kind of slash fiction, who wrote fiction between two men, almost because it was a way of exploring sexuality whilst also having that safety of the removal. And so that was always really interesting to me. And it's always been such a big part of my life. And I think it's all of my entire friendship group comes from fandom. So I have obviously my best friend in the entire world I met in Torchwood fandom. I have another group of very, very close friends who I've been friends with for over a decade now. And we met each other in EastEnders fandom. And wow. not even EastEnders fandom, a fandom for a very specific pairing of characters in EastEnders. So where we had our own little forum and everything. And we've known each other for over a decade now. So that's been where I've made my friendships, which is also a really important part of having a support network when you're figuring stuff out. And I've realized that group of people over time has gradually become more aware of its own queerness and more aware of its own neurodivergence as well. So a couple of my friends are now self-diagnosing as autistic. A couple have diagnoses of being autistic. A lot of us now identify as queer. I have a few who are now diagnosed ADHD or self-diagnosing as ADHD. So I think fandom is, or was, at least when I was a bit younger, was such an autistic space where you could kind of be autistic. It's detached enough from, it was almost like I was able to do the things that I can't do, like go out and socialize and have this close-knit group of friends like in school, and I always really struggled with that, but I found it through fandom. And I think it's just, I think fandom can be an incredibly toxic space, but it can also be an incredibly empowering space. I think particularly through things like fan fiction, when it was harder to find queer characters anywhere, yeah. It was through fandom. We characters would be headcanoned as gay or as bi or as trans, and you had shipping happened and obviously still happens. And even today, I have a list of characters who I headcanon as autistic, who are not officially autistic in the medium that they're in, but I could write for days about why I think they're autistic.
Same. I just written an article for a film magazine about that.
I love it so much. I'm sitting here and I'm sure I get it's very annoying for some people, because I'm just here going, doing a thread about Ben Mitchell and going, and I know he's not officially autistic, but in my head he definitely is, and so this is why he does this. And it's like, that's not in the show. And I'm like, is it not in the show? And and I often find myself identifying with characters that I'm headcanoning as autistic more than I identify with characters that are deliberately written to be autistic.
Yeah.
Because they're very rarely written by autistic people.
Yeah, they don't know what they're doing, do they? They're like, oh, I've written this quirky character. No, mate, you've written one of us. Yeah.
When they accidentally write an autistic character without realizing it, they do a better job than when they're trying to write an autistic character.
I just basically got chased from a Ted Lasso forum with like pitchforks because I dared to suggest that Keely demonstrates some autistic traits. So it's like she's like a fan favorite, and they were so angry about it. It was horrible, like in a neurotypical space. Like I'm sure if I put it in an autistic forum, people would be like, yeah, I can see that. Like I don't think she necessarily is, but I can see how she skews more autistic than other characters. But like, yeah, it's so they don't know what they're doing, do they, when they write us?
And I think there's something that's happened, there's a shift, I'm going to sound very much old man shouting at clouds and old lady screaming at kids to get off her lawn, which isn't my intention, but I know that's what it's going to come across as. But there is a sense, I think, and I talked about this with my friends, in the last few years, fandom has sort of felt slightly less safe from an autistic perspective.
Yeah.
And I've read some really great articles about it, and, you know, threads on Tumblr and Twitter and stuff, where it talked about how for such a long time it was such an autistic space. I mean, the thing that everybody did was squeeing, and that's a very autistic noise to be making. I mean, I make that noise when I'm excited. And it was all about being unapologetically flappy and obsessed and, you know, excitable and very, very neurodivergent, very, very autistic. And that was the heart of it. And that was, if you were in fandom and you weren't like that, you were kind of the odd one out. Which was different to in real life, she says in quotation marks. Whereas I think it's moved a little bit more into the mainstream. Not that that's a bad thing. I don't want to come across as a sort of, you know, bit hipster about it. But in kind of moving a bit more into the mainstream, those kind of very stereotypical fandom behaviours I'm now experiencing in fandom, people going, oh, don't do that, that's really cringy, or oh, that's really weird, why are you doing that? And I'm like, what do you mean, why am I doing it? This is fandom, this is what you do. And there's definitely been, and I think I talk about this with my friends, and that we kind of stick, although I do obviously talk about my fandoms publicly, a lot of my fandom interaction is now very, very insular, as in I have my safe space and my little group chat on WhatsApp, and I stay there, because I've been quite thoroughly mocked by some people in, for example, the Ben and Callum EastEnders fandom for behaving in a way that was so normal to behave in fandom for me when I was growing up.
That makes me angry.
It makes me really cross. And I think it is just that move towards, it feels like the peak, it feels like that some of the people who, for example, bullied me in school are now in those fandom spaces. But whereas before they'd have been the minority, it's not that they're now the majority, but it's now that because it is more mainstream, it's become less neurodivergent friendly. And it's become more sort of, oh, stop being so cringeworthy. And I hate the word cringe. I hate the word cringy.
Me too.
It's just, it's the killer of joy. I'm like, I know I'm going to be really excited about this. Let me.
I think it's a critical mass thing, isn't it? Like, I noticed with any fandom, like with the Neighbours fandom, the smaller the group, the less nonsense there is. And the more you sort of you gravitate around a topic that is maybe going to filter out some people like that. Like, for example, I listen to a podcast called Neighbours, and they are very much like a feminist podcast. And they're really funny. And they're like that, you know, it's sort of like quite an intelligent analysis of a very silly show. And the people that gravitate around that, it's a smallish group. There's about 500. And that sort of seems to be around the size that you can get without there being a massive conflict every 5 seconds. And like, so yeah, very, very interesting. But I don't think fandom is anything to be sniffed at. And I think for autistic people, these relationships are real life. And also, for new writers, fan fiction can be the way that you learn your craft. I know that Gabby Hutchinson Crouch, she's a wonderful writer. She writes fantasy and she writes comedy and comedy fantasy. She wrote a wonderful comedy feminist fairy tale series called the Darkwood series, which everyone should read. She also always talks about the importance of fan fiction in her development as a writer and how that's what she did before she had an official channel to write through, and that's how she learned. I can't believe we're running out of time. Unbelievable. I'm very excited about this. You started a YouTube channel, and I know that everyone wants to hear more about that because it's even more Erin. Yay!
I started a YouTube channel earlier in the year, and I did a few videos. I actually, what inspired the starting of the channel was actually me being very, 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 very pissed off about about Sia's film music. Yes. And being like, I need to rant about this for half an hour. And the response to that was really good. And then there was a couple of other videos that I did. Unfortunately, life happened since then. I was recording in my kitchen, so there wasn't I live with my mum, my stepmum, and my brother, and also we have two dogs. So it's very loud and it's quite busy. But also then a lot of it's been one of those horrible years where bad stuff just keeps happening. So I hit a bit of a burnout, and it just, I had all these ideas, but I couldn't put them down. But it is something that I really want to pursue because I loved doing it. We've now set aside some space in my bedroom to be like a little office space, because I'm officially now in my 9-to-5 going to be officially on a working from home contract, and not just it's a pandemic, so we're working from home, which is great. So I've got a space, I've got a bookshelf behind me that definitely doesn't have 5 copies of my own book, and just at head height so I can like self-advertise all the time. So it is something that I really loved doing. It has something to me that, you know, I do a lot of my work on Twitter, and I do a lot of Twitter threads, but there's something about actually talking at a camera that I really enjoy. So yeah, I'm hoping in the next, in the tail end of this year and going into next year, to actually get it up as a regular thing that I'm doing, maybe once a week or once every couple of weeks, because I really, really do enjoy it. So I'm just kind of pushing it out there to people, be like, come follow me, I will have content.
Well, that's something for us to all look forward to. I'm so excited about that. What do you feel? I hope there's better times ahead for you. You know, really sorry to hear that things have been, life has been coming at you hard, as they say. It's I every time I try to sound young, it just gets worse and worse. I'm 34, damn it. Things have been rough.
Who cares? I'm 30 in January, and I'm going to Disney for my 30th. So,
yay. Who cares?
I've just got confirmation. I'm in Magic Kingdom on my actual day of my birthday. Magic Kingdom.
Amazing. Well,
happy as Larry, I am.
Through you, age. There we go. Once you feel, you know, sort of up to it, what do you think is next for you? Do you have anything on the horizon that you're very excited about?
So yes, obviously the YouTube is something I really want to get into, but also I've had some interest from my publisher in turning Queerly Autistic into a workbook. Which I'm really keen to do, because I love workbooks, and I know that the Trans Teen Survival Guide has a workbook version, and I think the the Spectrum Girls Guide by Sienna Castellini, I've probably pronounced her surname wrong, I was at a protest with her once and she's lovely, you know, they've got workbook versions, and I really love them, so that's really exciting. Obviously not official yet, but it's what I want to do. I've got a couple of ideas for further books. I'd love to edit a collection of essays by queer and autistic people at some point. That's a dream of mine. And I'd also really like to write something which is basically an everyday guide to doing everyday things when you're autistic, like, oh, there's a tube strike and I need to get to work. What is some advice? And, you know, oh, I'm going out for drinks with my friends, but that's really, there's lots of noise and people, you know, things like that. Because that's something that doesn't exist, but I'd really love to be the one to have the privilege of doing it. So I've got a lot of ideas, a lot of things on the horizon. Hopefully when things pick back up, you know, we've had our, things are supposed to come in threes, aren't they? We've had our threes so far in the last 6 months. So hopefully it will start to pick back up again. And yeah, I think there's so much kind of stuff that I want to do. And I feel like with Queerly Autistic being out and having had amazing feedback, it feels like I have a platform to do it.
Well, you know what? The world is your oyster. Such exciting times. And I for one, cannot wait for your guide to doing things while autistic. Because I do not know what I'm doing. Please help me. That is a book that I need. I just can't wait to see what you do next. You've just been the most incredible guest. I just feel so lucky to have talked to you and to read your book. And thank you so, so, so much for writing it. And the world thanks you, I'm sure. And if you haven't got a copy yet, please get one, because it's absolutely life-changing. Erin, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I was so excited when I got your invitation. Keep up the good work as well. It's brilliant. I love this series so much.
Oh, thank you.
You've been listening to Aught Hour, hosted and produced by Sarah Gibbs. Today's guest was Erin Eakins. Her book, Queerly Autistic, The Ultimate Guide for LGBTQIA+ Teens on the Spectrum, is available online or at any good bookshop. Special thanks to Graham Rawson, who composed the Aught Hour theme, Graham Watson, who designed the Aught Hour logo, and John Gibbs, who edited this episode. If you like what you've heard, please hit subscribe, leave a review, or follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Aught Hour Pod. This was the season finale for our first season. Thank you to all our guests and listeners. We hope to see you again in the new year. Sarah's book, Drama Queen, One Autistic Woman and a Life of Unhelpful Labels, is out now. Find out more at sarahgibbs.com.